Hello, I'm Tamara Copeland, president of the Washington Regional Association of Grantmakers. For a while now, the philanthropic community across the greater Washington, D.C. region has been learning about the impact of racism. This segment of Putting Racism on the Table looks at implicit bias, how we can be biased for or against certain people and not even be aware of it. Leading the exploration of this topic is Julie Nelson, director of the Government Alliance on Race and Equity of the Haas Institute for a Fair and Inclusive Society.
I want to start by just voicing my appreciation for this whole series. We are going to be talking about implicit bias, and I want to be really clear that I want to not just talk about ideas around implicit bias, but really thinking about what actions we can take in relation to implicit bias. So that's the fair warning. Actions in thinking about the issue of race and racism was really not about African American people, but about white people. Because one of the things about race is that we often talk about race from a perspective of it's a system that has caused negative impacts for people of color. But it's really clear to me, too, that this is a damaging system that has caused huge dysfunction amongst white people. And the fact that because racism is a system that's been created around this concept of whiteness, it's really limited white people in the way that we have relationships with our own white people. For me, the theory of implicit bias and the research around it, where it is most useful is actually moving to action. So for us to be able to see what this is and what impact it has, and then to develop strategies to counter implicit bias. And so how do we actually look at the impacts of bias as they're playing out in our communities? And how does that inform what our strategies are? Because ultimately, that's what we want. We want to, when we're talking about race, right now, race can be used to predict how well you're going to do in any indicator for success. And so when we talk about racial equity, that's what we want to address, eliminate those inequities. So I want to share just a little bit about differences between explicit and implicit bias. Explicit bias is that which is expressed directly. It operates at the conscious level. People are much more likely to be aware of the fact that they have bias. Implicit bias is expressed indirectly at the unconscious level. Oftentimes, people don't even recognize that they have bias. And so an example here between the two. When I was the director of the Office for Civil Rights in Seattle, we did fair housing testing. And so what fair housing testing is that you send, when we're doing it on race, send a white person and an African-American person out to look for housing. They've got the exact same profile, the same income, the same rental history. The only thing that's different is their race. And then compare notes after the fact. Now, Seattle is a place that prides itself, I think, on being a progressive place. And there's lots of things that you can point to about Seattle being a progressive place. Seattle will tax itself endlessly. You put something on the ballot, a low-income housing levy, families and education levy, you put it on the ballot, Seattle voters will pass it. We've got more protected classes than just about anywhere in the country. So there's all these things that we can point to that we're good progressive people. And yet, when you look at racial inequity, we've got the same inequities, if not worse, than anywhere else in the country. And so thinking about something like fair housing, do this testing, the result was 69% differential treatment. 69%. That's over two-thirds differential treatment. So let's be clear what differential treatment means. There was not a single example of explicit bias or explicit racism. There were no signs posted in doors saying we don't rent to African Americans. What it did mean is that there was everything from different prices charged, hundreds of dollars difference in price depending on what your race was. There were differences in the number of units shown. So a white person would come and be shown, oh yeah, we've got 5 units. Let me walk you around and show all of them to you. African American person would come and it would be 1 unit available. So what do you do? You know, again, we don't want just information for the sake of information. Well, the legal standard for filing charges of discrimination is relatively high. And so what I needed to do was build cases, went back and did double testing, triple testing to develop a document, a pattern. And in those cases where we had a pattern, went after those landlords, filed charges of discrimination. That was one thing necessary to do that. However, there was this whole other group in the middle where it wasn't a pattern and it wasn't really clear sort of from a legal standard whether it was egregious enough or not. And so what we did actually is we took the data back to the landlords and had one-on-one conversations. But we knew that there was a fair number of them where it was actually implicit bias that was impacting behavior. And so the question is, what do you do with the fact that you have implicit bias in this situation that is having direct impact on people's lives? And so what we did, two things. Number one, we worked with the Rental Housing Association, which is a group of 95% of the landlords in Seattle, and came up with uniform policies. So when someone comes to look for housing, there is a checklist. Landlords do the exact same thing, regardless of who comes in the door. That's step one. Step two is that we did implicit bias training. That it turns out that if people are aware of the potential for bias playing out in their interactions from a behavioral perspective, it is contrary to what they're wanting to do. People, sort of from a value perspective, do not want to discriminate. And so giving them awareness of the fact that implicit bias was potentially playing out actually gave them the greater awareness to implement the policies, because from a perspective of changing outcomes, we have to focus both on policies and on practices. I want to give you a couple of other examples. For years, symphonies and orchestras were dominated by men. And so some symphonies and orchestras had this crazy idea that women were good musicians too. And so they had done all sorts of recruiting to try and get women as performers and had very marginal success. So what they decided based on implicit bias research was that gender, sort of the visual nature of gender, might be biasing their decision-making process. So they came up with the idea to do screened auditions. So when the person is performing, the person conducting the audition can't see who it is. The results were immediate. Depending on the symphony or orchestra, it increased overnight between 25 and 46%. That's a big increase. Would not have happened if they hadn't done that intervention. One of them took it a step further. They had this idea that the sound of footsteps walking across a stage is different than women's and men's footsteps sound different. And so what they did is that they made the performer stationary and had the person conducting the audition come in, and that increased the number of women an additional 10%. So again, emphasizing the start here was that there was recognition that there is disproportionality in what they were trying to achieve. They recognized that implicit bias might be impacting, and they had an intervention to remove implicit bias. Third example is around resume review processes. And this is research that fairly similar to the fair housing example, where applications, everything is the same for the applicant except for the name. So a white sounding name versus an African American sounding name. 50% more callbacks for white sounding names. 50% more callbacks. And so in this sort of environment where we're thinking that sort of we have a meritocracy and you work hard and you can make it, the reality that whether your name sounds like a white sounding name or an African American sounding name, really deeply troubling, right? So they did the same thing where they had conversations with HR managers around, you know, sort of what were the differences between the applicants here. Same thing. No, you know, we would never discriminate. You know, this is just not possible. And so the step that some firms have taken is actually to go to screened resumes. So you take the names off of resumes. Another thing that has helped in the hiring processes is instead of just having one person do reviews, to have multiple people do reviews. And the an additional thing is to disaggregate like the educational and the experience so that different people are rating the different parts of a resume, and that has also resulted in improved results. So the question is what to do with bias. Studies have actually shown that when people try to say they don't have bias, that it exacerbates bias. And it's a little bit counter to what one would hope. When people say things like, I don't have bias or I don't see color, they are actually saying it with good intent. But the reality is that saying that means that you're denying, actually, neurologists can hook you up to monitors and show that you do see race, that race is actually immediate, like 0.01 second, that people do see race. So it's simply not scientifically possible. But then if you're saying, I don't see race or I don't have bias, actually it doesn't give you the opportunity for intervention. And so instead of just saying we don't have bias, it's important for us to recognize that by virtue of being socialized in the United States, we all have bias. We have both individual and institutional biases, and we've got it happening at the explicit and implicit level. And so we have typically, when we've talked about bias, thought about it from a perspective of individual and explicit. That's the way it gets framed in the media all the time, where someone says or does something, it's a headline, and there's endless conversations about, you know, can you believe so-and-so said that? I think that's racist. You know, that idea that race is all about individuals and that it's explicit in nature. Well, what we know, actually, is that the way that outcomes are generated is not just by individual acts of bigotry. And that is why we need to focus on implicit at the institutional level as well. So this is an example based on some work with the Seattle Police Department. Police officers themselves gave these examples. Institutional and explicit bias. An example that they came up with was a police department refusing to hire people of color. That would be institutional and it would be explicit. The example of institutional and implicit bias that they came up with was a police department focusing on street-level drug arrest, drug dealing. And I loved this as an example because it was really based on their own experience. And the data is interesting. Let me ask you, who uses drugs more, white people or people of color? White people. Depends a little bit on the specific drug. There's some variation, but overall numbers, white people use drugs more than people of color do. Who deals drugs more, white people or people of color? The numbers are actually fairly equal around drug dealing. But if you look at the criminal justice system, every single step of the process from who gets stopped, who gets arrested, who gets charged, who gets prosecuted, who goes to jail, how much time they spend in jail, every single step of the process, there's more and more disproportionality until we get to the end result where we've got mass incarceration, especially for African American men, Latino men as well, but disproportionality in the criminal justice system. So in a conversation with police officers, they talked about rolling back to look at the very first step. If we know that people of color and white people deal drugs at the same level, why is it that we have such disproportionality in who gets stopped? Well, what they said is that people of color and white people deal drugs differently. There's patterns. They're not rules, but general patterns. How do white people more commonly deal drugs? Country clubs and restaurants,
bars and parties.
Much more likely in social settings, out of college dorms, that there's much, much less likely to be street-level drug dealing. Street-level drug dealing, much more likely to be African-American or Latino. General pattern, not a rule, but that patterns are what we're looking for. It's complicated, street-level drug dealing, because the reality is that if drugs are being dealt with in front of your house or your business, there's a strong likelihood that you're going to call 911, right? It's a nuisance. No one likes open-air drug markets in front of their residents. And so the fact that police are responding to 911 calls is not the problem. No suggestion that we depolice, but we need to look at it from a more holistic perspective as a part of the criminal justice system if we want to get to different outcomes. Okay, the example around individual and explicit, this would be sort of your stereotypical headline example of a police officer using a racial slur while arresting someone. And sometimes worse than just arresting someone. Individual and implicit, the example they came up with here is that a police officer more likely to call for backup if the suspect is a person of color. There actually have been studies done that have shown that this isn't just a matter of an individual police officer being more likely to call for backup if the suspect is a person of color. But again, it's a pattern that takes place across police officers in a police department and across police departments across the country. So when something is in the individual and implicit category, always want to encourage people to look at it from a perspective of the institution. Because if it is an institutional pattern, then we need to have an institutional response to it. Make sense? Part of my emphasis in focusing on outcome is that we need to have sort of complex enough understanding so that we can say, yeah, it's income and class or income and race at the same time. The necessity of pulling them apart, we really emphasize centering on race because of the reality that race is so often the elephant in the room. And we have seen too many strategies that are quote unquote about ending class-based differences that actually perpetuate racial inequities. So that's not to say you don't talk about income inequality or gender inequality, but that we just have to have a complex enough understanding of it. Well, when Seattle first started the Race Social Justice Initiative, one of the initial concerns that was expressed by some department directors was a concern that it's going to be divisive, that it's going to cause stress and tension in the workplace. The thing that was interesting about sort of the question of whether it was going to be divisive, we did employee surveys every 2 years, specifically around racial equity, and what we found is that the departments that were most aggressive in working on racial equity were the ones that had the healthiest workplaces. That it actually increased the positive morale in workplaces. And what we find is that the reality that we are so uncomfortable to talk about race, that's what's creating tension. And so really just naming it is oftentimes a breath of fresh air. What the research shows, there's sort of fast thinking and slow thinking when it comes to the way that your brain processes. And racial bias resides in the part of your brain that's unconscious and fast thinking. So it's where, you know, sort of the gut reaction kicks in. And so slowing down in making decisions actually allows you to have better ability to counter bias. So yes, definitely. And it's part of like thinking about why we advocate so strongly for putting racial equity into decision-making processes. Want to move on to thinking about how we move on beyond implicit bias. The first thing is around normalizing conversations about race. And if we can't talk about something, then we are not going to be able to develop strategies to get to different outcomes. And so having a shared analysis, shared definitions, really, really critical. Implicit bias is one of those definitions. Second thing around normalizing is that we have to create greater urgency and make work to advance racial equity a priority. That as it is right now, it feels like it's the exact opposite. That year after year, we have report after report that comes out looking at disproportionality in education and criminal justice. You name it, we've got reports, and it almost feels like instead of a priority, it's a collective shrug of the shoulders. We know that change can happen, and change can happen quickly when it's a priority. And the truth is, we create our own conditions. I was on a panel with a police chief, with in front of a group of police officers and community members, and the police chief kept talking about how hard change is. He said it repeatedly: change is hard, and change takes time. While I appreciated at a certain level the sentiment that he was conveying, I also think we create our own reality. And if you do not want change to happen, all you have to do is keep repeating how hard it is. You tell people it's going to take a long time, and you are guaranteed that it will take a long time. So we have to have greater urgency in the work that we're doing. Second big bucket is around operationalizing. So we want to take that theory and put it into practice. One of the ways that we talk about that is using a racial equity toolkit. So when decisions are being made, that we're actually putting race into the discussion. Otherwise, we will just keep perpetuating the status quo. The other part about operationalizing is around data. And I can be a bit of a data geek. I love data. And the question is not just having data, but what we're going to use it for. Have data, develop strategies to get to different outcomes, and then track data. Are we having the impact that we desire? Because if we're not, what we need to do is go back to the drawing board. We either need to be doing something different, or we need to be doing more of something. But if we're just throwing money into something, or if we're just saying this policy is going to work and it's not having impact, then we have got to shift our thinking, and data will help us do that. The third thing is around organizing. And I know that typically we think about organizing from the perspective of community organizing. And that's the way that the much change has actually happened. For us to actually create change within institutions, within organizations, it's critical for us to think about internal organizing. So not just about outside, but internal organizing. And we have to recognize that to achieve impact, we have to work across sectors, across institutions, always putting community at the very center of what it is we're doing. In addition, really critical for us to think about all of this work from a values perspective and want to name the reality that there are deeply contradictory values in the United States, where we can look at the, and actually research shows that when people are asked what are the distinctly held values in the United States, time and time again, people will say equality and justice. That those are values. And there are some ways that you can look at the history of the country and say, yeah, we have valued equality since the very beginning of the country, right? Take the statement, all men are created equal. When Thomas Jefferson wrote, all men are created equal, who was he including? White men who owned property, right? And so the idea that we have had equality as a foundation of our country, equality has changed over the course of our country's history. The idea around how we socialize values of equality and justice. On a daily basis, millions upon millions of school children recite the Pledge of Allegiance, saying with liberty and justice for all. We're socialized around these as values, and we hold them as values, but we do not actually achieve our values. So coming from a values perspective, what we need to do is think about those values, not just as sort of, you know, things that we're holding as good intention, but that actually we are behaving in accordance with our values. And then last thing, just not to get too heavy on the government piece, but the statement, government of the people, by the people, for the people. Abraham Lincoln, thinking about government in context after the Civil War, this idea of who government is, who government serves, what government is and could be, all of that is really critical for us to think about getting to different outcomes. The role of the public sector being around public service. It's not just government, it's every institution. And racial inequities are not random, that they are not natural, that they were intentionally created over the course of centuries. From an explicit perspective. And so from a legal perspective, laws, policies, practices, everything from who could vote to who could be a citizen, who could own property, who was property, whose land was whose. All of those intentionally created racial inequities over the course of centuries. So that's sort of just the historical fact of the way that racial inequities were created. We started to see that change with the civil rights movement, right? Was it the case that one day government woke up and said, you know, let's pass the Civil Rights Act? It was the reality that community organizing, marching in the streets, demanding the Civil Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act, Voting Rights Act, that it was because of community organizing that those things happened. Unfortunately, what happened after the civil rights movement is that we moved into this era of being, quote unquote, colorblind or race neutral. That what we have seen over the past decades is that we do not have to name race because we have implicit bias that can achieve the same outcomes, the same racial inequities. So the question for us today is not whether or not there's racial inequity or whether there's implicit bias, but what we're actually going to do with it. Because what we have been doing is merely perpetuating the status quo. So that's my quick history lesson. The current context is fascinating, that we have an opportunity right now that I talked about urgency. It really is the urgency of the moment, that this election cycle, clearly race is being played out in a very real way. Looking at the reality that after Obama was elected, so many people said, did not think I would see an African-American president in my lifetime. And the reality that after Obama was elected, we saw an increase in hate crimes and we saw an increase in explicit acts of racism. Mm-hmm. We also have seen over the past, going on 2 years now, from Ferguson to Baltimore to Minneapolis to Madison, so many cities across the country where we have seen criminal justice in the headlines. What I want to say about that, however, is that the Ferguson report, the thing that I thought was most sort of glaring to me was not all the stuff around criminal justice, but was about the difference in life expectancy. Difference in life expectancy of 30 years. 30 years of life. I mean, to me, that like it's really sickening, you know, that your race predicts how long you're going to live. National average is a little bit less than 10 years, which is sickening enough. But when you look at the Ferguson report, 30 years difference in life. So, and that does not come about because of police officers killing people. That it comes about because we have entire systems and structures that are working better for white people than for people of color. So we have to look at it from a systems and structure perspective. But I want to talk about the difference between equity and equality and use a gender bathroom example. So you all have been at a major sporting event, musical event, halftime or intermission comes out, and everyone goes to the bathroom. So we have an equal number of bathrooms, and we have a very different experience. And so thinking about the difference between equality and equity, what we're looking for is the similarity in experience. So having an equal number of bathrooms doesn't work. It doesn't work for any of us. What are men doing while women are standing in line? They're waiting. Yeah. They might be waiting to get a beer. And they might be waiting in an outer circle, waiting for... But men have women in their lives, whether they're partners, daughters, mothers, sisters, friends, that men are waiting for women. Oftentimes we look, when there's an inequity, at the group that is most sort of visibly impacted by something. But when we have systems and structures that are not working, they are fundamentally broken for all of us. And so it's a really important point when we're oftentimes approaching ideas about equity from a scarcity perspective. We are not talking about making things worse for some. We're talking about making systems and structures work for everyone. And again, with the bathroom example, simple policy decisions or program decisions that can have an impact, that it's a design issue. And it's also something that we can look at from an intersection perspective, that having family-friendly restrooms, having trans-friendly restrooms, that those are things that actually are at the intersection of gender and race and family, all of it coming together, but looking at it from a policy or program perspective. So we know that racial inequity can be used to predict how well you're going to do any indicator for success. So that's how we oftentimes approach issues of race, looking at the inequities. That's important, and it's not sufficient, that we really need to have a vision for what racial equity would look like. And so we not only need to close the gaps, but we need to improve success for everyone. That when you take something like our public education system, you can look at the fact that there's huge disproportionality right now, that the data in Seattle actually is 50% of African American and Latino students graduating from high school on time. 50%. I mean, that's not an okay number. We can also look at the number for white kids, and the graduation rate for white kids on time is just slightly over 80%. Is 80% something we should be proud of?
Nope.
No. We need a public education system where all of our kids can graduate on time. So closing the gaps doesn't mean sort of averaging them, but actually designing them so that we get the outcomes we're looking for everyone. Oftentimes for both foundations and government, I would say, is that there's a tendency to want to fund programs or services, which the intention is really, really good. Human services matter, but if they are just band-aids, if we're just treating the symptoms and not treating the cause, we are not doing enough. We will never be able to achieve equity if we're just treating symptoms. So have to move beyond programs and services and thinking about policies and organizational cultures that perpetuate inequities. Last definitional piece that I want to share is around different types of racism. These are the definitions that the Government Alliance on Race and Equity uses. Oftentimes I'm asked the question, do we have to talk about racism? And I, you know, love the title of your series, Putting Racism on the Table, because you all clearly are talking about racism, and it makes a difference. It's really important for people to understand different types of racism. If you're coming into a conversation and people are thinking, we're just talking about individual acts of bigotry, and then other people are thinking about institutional and structural racism, if some people are thinking that they're denying that racial inequities exist, you're not going to have a helpful conversation. So having clarity around these definitions is really critical. Institutional racism, policies, practices, and procedures that work better for white people than for people of color, often unintentionally or inadvertently. Going back to implicit bias, meaning that we don't actually name race, it's just that they work better for white people than for people of color. Structural racism means that we not only have institutionalized racism in a few organizations, but we've got it consistent across all organizations. Plus, we've got this historical legacy of racism, and we've got a culture where racism has been a part of the culture. So for us to get to different outcomes in the community, we have to be able to focus at the structural level and want to say on top of that, where most of us have the best ability to influence is at the institutional level. So always try to encourage people, yes, work on the institutionalized racism within your own organization. Don't get freaked out about it. Just name it as a reality. And then you can pinpoint where there's opportunities for change. And it's collectively that we can then come together to work on structural racism. When we talk about normalizing conversations about race, the things that we think are really critical to name are the history of racial inequities being intentionally created, the difference between implicit and explicit bias, differences between individual, institutional, and structural racism, and the differences between racial equity and racial inequity. Four simple concepts, and once people have those nailed, you can then have really great conversations around operationalizing and organizing. which brings me to operationalizing. I'm going to just touch on a few things here and use them as examples. Do full workshops talking about using a racial equity tool, really digging in and looking at policies. This, again, says government policies. I will share examples from government policies, but the truth is that foundations also have policies. So think about the applicability of using a racial equity tool within your own organization. So with the Federal Housing Administration, how did the Federal Housing Administration deal with race, thinking back to the 30s and 40s? Redlining. And there is also the mortgage lending, where the mortgage lending went disproportionately to white communities. This is important, not just because of the reality that these policies created segregation. It's also important because of the reality that the intergenerational accumulation of wealth, that was the key part of the accumulation of wealth. So the huge disproportionality, 8-1, 10 years ago between African Americans and whites, has actually increased instead of gotten better because of the disproportionate impact of the housing foreclosure crisis. Mm-hmm. Another example where things are located. Street lighting is an excellent example of implicit bias at an institutional level from Seattle. And it actually did not come originally as the topic street lighting. It happened because of concerns around youth violence. Seattle has a relatively low homicide rate. And about 6 years ago, there was actually a series of shootings where five young African-American men had been killed. I say men, but they were actually teenagers. They were children. They ranged in age between 14 and 17. So young people shot and killed. And the mayor at the time said, this is not acceptable. This is not Seattle. I want to do something to address youth violence. And so he did what mayors sometimes do in such situations, got a van load of people from the city and went out to the neighborhood to visit the neighborhood. And as they were rolling down the major thoroughfare in southeast Seattle, which is where there's a high percent of people with low incomes, communities of color, and immigrants and refugees, he started noticing that streetlights were out. And so he asked the question, why are all these streetlights out? There was not a city policy that we do not replace streetlights in communities of color. Mm-hmm. It's an appropriate question for him to be asking. So the city light staff went back and used a racial equity tool to try and figure out why it was that that was the reality. They started by counting, using data, counted the number of streetlights that were out. Turns out that there were 80 streetlights out in this small neighborhood. And I can tell you, there is not another neighborhood in Seattle where you would have found that level of streetlights being out. And so then the question becomes, why? So they analyzed what's the practice? How do we actually replace streetlights? Turns out at the time, the process was that each streetlight, each pole, had a number on it. When your streetlight in front of your house or your business burnt out, it was your responsibility to call the city and say the streetlight's burnt out. And then the city would come out and replace the streetlight. So in a neighborhood that's a high percent communities of color, people with low incomes, and people who are immigrants and refugees, why would that possibly be a system that would produce that outcome? Lack of knowledge. And I want to say I had worked for the city for 15 years, and I did not know that it was my responsibility. And so the question is, from a process perspective, it's not like that's the only way to get streetlights replaced. So that led to a whole conversation around alternative processes. They ended up analyzing a process that instead of a complaint-based system, doing a geographic replacement. Turns out that light bulbs have an anticipated life. You can put it in and you know that 5 years later, 10 years later, the technology is improving. It will burn out within that period of time. So go in, change all the light bulbs, and then come back 5 years later, 10 years later, and you know they're going to burn out, so replace them. We were in the middle of a recession. There was concern that this was going to be expensive. Did a cost analysis. Turns out it saved the city money. So it provided better customer service to everyone and saved the city money. It also led to an incredible conversation around complaint-based systems. Because there are a multitude of complaint-based systems, all of which perpetuate the same inequities. Whether you're talking about potholes or housing code violations or graffiti removal, so many things, complaint-based systems. So did a broad assessment. Other thing around coming back to the criminal justice issue, the other part of it that was kind of a contradiction is that when the city was asked for advice around public safety issues, the advice the city would give neighborhood groups is public lighting, that's a large deterrent to crime. And here we weren't providing the basic service. So that's an example of race and government policies from an implicit perspective. Just want to keep coming back to that implicit bias is not just about individuals, but it's around the way that our institutions operate. Using a racial equity tool means that we are actively inserting race into a decision-making process. The analogy that I sometimes give is with an environmental impact statement. When environmentalists were trying to get EISs as a part of the public review process, the private developers weren't actually very enthusiastic about it, that there were concerns about it from a perspective of adding time, costing money, inappropriate interference of government in the private sector. And yet what happened is that government said, no, we have the environment as a public value, and we will consider the environment when projects are being proposed. We want to do the same thing from a racial equity perspective. We know that when decisions are being made in your organizations, in government, that there are racial equity impacts. If we are not clearly putting race on the table, we are likely to just keep perpetuating the status quo. The analogy with the environmental impact statement is that not perfect, because EISs in general are done once and then the project is built or not. With a racial equity tool, what we say is that it's both a process and a product. So want to come back and use a racial equity tool repeatedly, trying to drive towards the outcome. Who should use a racial equity tool? You all should use a racial equity tool. Government, elected officials, community, across the board. Anyone who is trying to get to different outcomes, anyone who is trying to eliminate racial inequities, you have to put race into decision-making processes. Otherwise, you perpetuate status quo. So your grant award processes, racial equity should be on the table in the process, in the consideration around the outcomes as well. I'm going to give one more example around use of a racial equity tool, just sort of that I think is really important in delineating when one is used and when one is not. We had a group of people that included community organizations, funders, and government who were trying to do an intervention looking at youth involved with the criminal justice system. So what they knew was that kids were not appearing for their court dates. And it turns out that if you're in trouble with the law and you miss your court appearance, you get into even more trouble. And so they were trying to have an intervention to get kids to show up for their court dates. So the first thing that they came up with was that they sent a reminder letter to young people. Reminder letter went in the mail. Kids, theory was they'd get it, show up for their court date. What do you think happened? Okay, this is fascinating, because actually, they were tracking the data, came back 6 months later to look at the data, and overall results were up, that people, you know, that there were more kids that were showing up for their court appearances. However, they also were interested in race. When they analyzed the data by race, what they found was that was a strategy that worked well for white kids, did not work so well for kids of color. Many of the reasons that you named around the street lighting example, same reasons here. Greater mobility, less likelihood to speak English, less trust in the system, letter from government comes, whether you're going to look at it or not. All these reasons why that process achieves that outcome. So after the fact, they decided, after analyzing data, that's not the outcome we wanted. We need to go back and use the racial equity tool. Should have done it from the beginning, but good thing they did it, better late than never. And the step that they had missed was around engagement. So they went and had some meetings with young people who were involved in the criminal justice system. And not a single one of the young people said, send me a letter in the mail. What the young people did say is call or text, and hopefully from a community-based organization. Don't want those calls coming from the court system or the police system. Would really rather have it from a community-based organization. Second thing was around transportation. They needed help getting to some of the courts. So two things. Implemented those two things, tracked the data, came back 6 months later. Overall numbers stayed high. Turns out that it's not that the white kids really loved the letters in the mail. They were just as happy to have a text or phone call as well. So intervention, naming the fact that you've got disproportionality and that there's implicit bias that's playing out, not intentional racism here, coming up with a strategy to get to a different outcome. Last thing I'm going to talk about is organizing. And organizing is something that really needs to be taking place within our own institutions and across institutions. The infrastructure, and this gets back to the point around accountability, because there needs to be accountability built into the organizing that we're doing. This is a model that is based on organizing within government, but it is, you know, really could be about any organization. That organization structure needs to be mimicked so that we have racial equity teams within departments, within sections. I don't know sort of within your foundations how you characterize the sort of infrastructure part of it, but racial equity teams need to exist within your foundation. This is the case in government, that having a racial equity team and racial equity action plan in every single department is key for accountability. That when you have that, you can then have accountability agreements with department directors around what's going to take place when, and you can track whether stuff gets done. That having an action plan, you know, sometimes there's a nervousness around having an action plan because it can all feel so overwhelming. There's so much work to do. We do not go from A to Z in one fell swoop. We go from A to B to C. Having a plan to get us to Z is really critical. So developing work plans both on an individual department perspective and across the institution. The other accountability mechanisms that are really critical are around using a racial equity tool and using a communications tool as well. That a communications tool means that we are communicating about race in a way that advances racial equity. Sometimes when we're talking about race, we can actually do it from a perspective that perpetuates racial inequities. So if you are not framing and messaging around race, what you can actually do is trigger implicit bias and perpetuate stereotypes. So if a report comes out around disproportionality in high school graduation rates, if it is just presented as data, implicit bias can get triggered time and time again. What people will walk away from that headline is that kids of color aren't smart, their families don't care, they skip school, all of the things that we are not trying to, that's not the intentional message that we're trying to advance. So for us to actually use a communications tool means that we're inserting racial equity into our communications in a way that advances racial equity. That means that we start with shared values before we name race, and then when we do name racial inequities, we always draw to institutional solutions, not blaming the victim, not treating symptoms, really looking at institutional responses, and then ending with action. So start with affirmation, then do a counter around communicating about race, and then transformation, taking action. That's really a quick summary around communications. Last thing I'll say is around changing minds. A lot of times people will think, you know, we got to talk one-on-one to change people's hearts, change people's minds. What the research actually shows is that the best way to change attitude is to change behavior. change behavior. When you have an organization that's saying, yes, racial equity is a value, and we have a racial equity plan, and you all are going to use a racial equity tool, first time that people use a racial equity tool, there might be looks of confusion on people's faces. But as we normalize conversations about race and people gain experience, behavior changes and attitude changes. We don't start with attitude, we start with behavior. The other thing around sort of getting organizational change is thinking about it both short-term and long-term, that these inequities were created over hundreds upon hundreds of years. We have to create urgency to make it move quickly, and we have to have a long-term plan. You know, how are we going to do it 1 year at a time, sort of one step at a time? Make it some, have some success built in so that we can actually see the progress that's being made. So with that, I am going to close, and I'll just say importance of advancing racial equity. Key part of that is creating an effective and inclusive democracy, that those values around democracy and equity have to be really closely integrated.
Has putting racism on the table broadened your understanding of racism? Let's keep the conversation going. Leave a message at Copeland@WashingtonGrantmakers.org or via Twitter at RagPrez, WRAG. P-R-E-Z, and tell your friends and family about this new podcast series.